the withdrawal of the U.S. forces.
Due to buzzer shortage and increasing prices of food and medical goods, Afghans in major cities and villages demand humanitarian aids. Furthermore, they're concerned about their assets being frozen by the U.S.
We are in a critical situation. Public assets, including our salaries, have been blocked and most of us have lost our jobs. We demand neighboring countries to provide us with humanitarian aid.
Afghanistan's economy, which depends on foreign aid, suffered a big loss in the recent change of government. The people of Afghanistan look forward to receiving international aid, calling for an end to sanctions on Afghanistan as soon as possible. They believe that blocking the assets of Afghans by U.S. government puts the people under pressure rather than the Taliban. The United Nations has warned of a looming food crisis in Afghanistan. The UN has also said that its food stocks in the country could run out by the end of September, further pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A number of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers during military raids into different areas in Jenin and northwest of Al-Quds. Three Palestinians were killed near the towns of Beit Anan and Biddu northwest of Al-Quds. The Israeli military said its forces had been tracking a Hamas movement cell for several days and had conducted a wave of operations against the movement across the West Bank and killed Ahmad Zahran, Mahmoud Ahmedan and Zakaria Badwan, all from Biddu town.
We were shocked by the martyrdom of a number of our sons. We say their blood will pave the way for the Palestinians to go ahead with their fight against the occupation. This is only one part of the Zionist violation against our people.
In the village of Burqin, southwest of Jenin, 16-year-old Yusuf Sabah was killed during the clashes and his body was confiscated by the Israeli forces. 22-year-old Osama Subh was another Palestinian from Burqin killed by Israeli forces. He succumbed to his injuries in a hospital in the city. Palestinian Islamic Jihad later endorsed him as a group member and threatened that black days await Israel in the West Bank and its crimes will only intensify the movement's resistance and unity. Thousands took part in his funeral procession. His wedding was planned for next month, his father told us.
We received the news with utter shock and immense sadness, but no objection. It's Allah's will. Osama's wedding was supposed to be next month, but he was chosen to be martyred.
Two Israeli soldiers were seriously injured during the clashes that broke out between Palestinians and Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issued a statement backing the military's operation.
Palestinians say Israel uses lethal force to stem anti-regime resistance in the occupied territories. But they say Tel Aviv will fail to intimidate them into giving up their struggle. Muna Qandil, Occupy Jamallah.
September 26 marks the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian Journalists, initially declared by the International Federation of Journalists in 1996. To this end, Palestinians held a sit-in rally in front of the house of the journalist Yusuf Abu Hussein, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes during the last escalation in the Gaza Strip.
Yusuf has been targeted inside his home. Israeli regime intends to target journalists in an attempt to hide the truth of this inhuman regime from being delivered to the world. This is totally against international law to target civilians.
There are 24 Palestinian journalists inside Israeli jails, including a female journalist. There are also a huge number of journalists that were injured and others killed while doing their work.
Palestinian journalists and media outlets have always been a direct target of the Israeli regime. Hundreds of journalists have been killed or injured while covering the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
This is a stand to express our support and loyalty to our colleagues who have been killed or arrested by the Israeli regime for only covering the truth. This event is held to highlight that we won't allow the international community to ignore the Israeli crimes committed against journalists. During the last escalation, we lost Youssef. 35 media institutions were bombed and more than 12 journalists were injured.
Palestinians called on the international media organizations to show solidarity with Palestinian journalists and take steps to provide them with security.
During the recent escalation of unrest in Gaza, the Israeli regime has intentionally targeted Palestinian journalists and destroyed several media offices in a bid to block the truth. Palestinians here call on the international community to provide protection and security for journalists and hold Israel accountable for committing atrocities against them. Rova Shavit, Gaza.
This is the second time that the aircraft that belongs to Iran's Mahan Airlines lands here in Kabul International Airport since the beginning of September to deliver tons of humanitarian aids to war-weary Afghans who are experiencing difficult days due to poverty and joblessness.
This is the second time that we have brought some food for the Afghani people. Before the previous time, it was about 25 pounds. 20 tons of food and 5 tons of medicine. This time it is all food.
The flow of humanitarian aid by Iran to Afghanistan is welcomed by all in Afghanistan, saying their country needs more assistance to save the lives of millions of ordinary people who are at risk of hunger and malnutrition. They also believe there must be a transparent process to distribute the aids to most needy ones.
Given that poverty and joblessness are on the rise in Afghanistan, I think it would be better for donors to first provide food and then pay serious attention to the healthcare sector.
We have been receiving international aid since 2001 during the rule of Karzai and Ghani over Afghanistan, but all to no avail, because poverty is still bothering our people. So my suggestion is that these aids must be distributed first among the most vulnerable, poor and jobless people.
Iran has pledged to continue its support to Afghanistan and its people in different economic, humanitarian, political and security fields. This comes as Taliban takeover in mid-August suddenly changed the situation in Afghanistan, and of course, it also brought some major changes in the policies of some Western states, mainly the U.S. toward Afghanistan, such as freezing Afghanistan's assets. The freeze of Afghanistan's reserves by the U.S. is labeled as an illegal move by Washington against ordinary people. That is why Afghans widely condemn the move and ask why ordinary Afghans should pay the price of Washington's defeat in Afghanistan. However, Afghans look to supportive stances and moves of some neighboring countries like Iran as an example of honesty and true cooperation with Afghans. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands of people took to the streets in Damascus to mark Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. Mourners from Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Bahrain walked their way from different parts of Damascus to Sayyida Zainab Shrine, the sister of Imam Hussein, to mark the occasion.
We came walking from Sayyida Ruqayyah Shrine to Sayyida Zainab. We don't care about terrorism or takfirism. We will every year mark this day and renew devotion to Imam Hussein and Sayyida Zainab. We learn patience and faith, courage and sacrifice from them.
Whatever we do, it's nothing compared to the sacrifices of Imam Hussein. We came on foot from our homes to express condolences to Sayyida Zainab on her brother's martyrdom.
Wearing black clothes, visitors flocked demonstrating the events that took place on the day Imam Hussein was killed by the tyrant of his time, Yazid. They chanted slogans expressing condolences and love to the Imam, as well as devotion to remain adherent to the principles of Imam Hussein, who sacrificed his life to confront injustice, tyranny, and oppression.
Our message to all those who love Imam Hussein is that the Waqf captives will remain alive in our memory. We are representing today what happened on Ashura to revive the events that happened that day.
The significance of commemorating Arba'een at Sayyida Zainab's shrine is the fact that she was a symbol of resistance after her brother's martyrdom in the face of enemies. The shrine was also a target of the oppressors of our time, the US-backed terrorists. The sacrifices of resistance fighters, however, kept it secured.
Syrian Muslims have never failed to mark Arba'een in holy shrines, even at such critical times as the coronavirus pandemic. Their attendance here is a message of adherence to resistance against injustice at all times and a reiteration of their commitment to the path of Imam Hussein. Hamad Ali from Sayyida Zainab, Damascus Countryside.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain is speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but Thou, Thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal. And Thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is Thy servant and Thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which Thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in Thy religion as long as Thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after Thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from Thee. Surely, Thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which Thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which Thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only Thou, art the mighty ones.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. Fishing rights for EU boats in UK waters was a key stumbling block in negotiations for a Brexit trade accord between London and Brussels, which threatened to sink the deal. Well, it has resurfaced again. Britain said that it would grant just 12 out of 47 applications for new licenses for small EU boats, and then 75 applications from French boats to fish in its territorial waters. France has promised retaliation. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the UK is going against this agreement that was made on the Brexit talks. Let's get some details from Amina Taylor, a correspondent who joins us from London. Well, obviously, France is angry. It is promising retaliation, Amina, and tell us more details behind the story.
Well, it seems this is yet another war of words salvo here from the British, and you can justifiably see why the French are upset. There was the promise that vessels that were 12 meters and under and who had a proven record of fishing in inshore British waters would be granted a license, providing everything was above board. And by rejecting 75% of those French applications, the Brits, according to the French, are using this as political gain. Now, we have to recall that not only were these negotiations to try and sort out fishing rights really tense in the lead up to the signing of Brexit, we're even talking back in May here, where boats from the United Kingdom were sent out to Jersey to protect the Jersey coast there. After there was a French flotilla to really protest against what they saw as the Brits unnecessarily and unfairly dealing with their ships. So we see things are already tense with France. We had that Australia U.S. deal just a few weeks ago where ambassadors were recalled. There are still tensions around Brexit. There are those who say perhaps this is a smokescreen in time for the Tory Party conference on the weekend to show that we're back to meaning business about Brexit, and it doesn't matter if we offend our one-time closest ally in order to do so. Watch this space, Carvey.
Okay, Brexit just doesn't end, does it? Okay, very well. Thank you for that, Amina. We appreciate it. Let's bring in Senior Analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Ian Williams. Also joining us, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling, who joins us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Tony Gosling, I'm going to start with you first here. If you can, give us a quick wrap-up, even though our first one kind of did. But tell us exactly what's going on here.
Okay, so look, the background to this is Britain was, I stress, was a great maritime power, particularly during the Second World War, and they absolutely dominated. We dominated this part of the world. We could fish pretty much where we wanted to, and also could stop others fishing where you didn't want to. But that all changed when we joined the European Union. And around about the same time, in fact, we had a Cod War with the Icelandics because we were pushing closer and closer the British fishing vessels to Iceland. And so the Icelandics, quite rightly, well, you know what they did? They extended their fishing range around Iceland, so pushing the British back. And in fact, in 1974, I think it was, there was even a pursuit over 100 nautical miles of a British fishing ship by the Icelandics, who successfully shot at it and captured it because they'd been fishing within the new limits. So this is quite a hot issue in the past. I think this is why the British have now decided that they're only going to award a quarter of the licenses the French have asked for. Now, let's be clear here. It is in the British government's behest to award or not award these licenses. So they will be looking through every application to find any tiny little mistake that the French have made in order to reject that application. So they're dealing with a hostile bureaucracy, basically. And I think it's only fair also to stress that one of the main priorities of the British at the moment is trying to restore stocks of fish, because we've had, under the European Union, a massive depletion of fishing stocks around the British Isles, and one of the main priorities of the British government has been to try and restore those fish stocks. So they're trying. I mean, we haven't got, the British don't have the fishing fleet to fish anything like what we used to do, but they are trying to make sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed and all of these applications before they're granting the rights to these French. So I would suggest that actually these French fishing owners, rather than trying to turn this into a row, should just double-check that they've got everything right on these applications, send them in again before they make too much of a fuss, because this is now the British's right to say whether or not they can fish there.
Do you agree with that, Ian Williams?
If there is plenty of room for misunderstanding all around. The European fisheries deal was one of the worst aspects of the EU accession for Britain. It destroyed what was left almost of Britain's commercial fishing fleet, and it threw open the so-called British waters. I don't think the fish carry passports, by the way, but it threw open the British waters to competition from lightly regulated, highly subsidized continental fishing fleets. The British government has not really believed in subsidies, certainly not the way the Europeans do. So, I mean, the whole economics of deep-sea fishing is very murky at the best of times. There's huge subsidies, huge DAS discounts, because these are very vociferous and noisy political constituencies, no more so than the French. You know, the French fishermen were threatening to blockade the port, threatening to blockade Calais. And, you know, there are different attitudes here. The French fishermen and French peasants can get away with things like that. I wouldn't like to try to, if I was an English fisherman or an English farmer trying to blockade the main road, I think the British police would take a very dull view and wouldn't really notice whether or not you're a politically important constituency or not. They bulldoze right through you and arrest you all. So it's different. There's a clash here. But certainly the point is the European, these waters have been drastically overfished. There's far more fish coming out of them than is sustainable. And it's very difficult to police because in the terms of the UN treaty, these are straddling and highly migratory fish stocks. They move from spawning grounds to other parts, you know, from one end of the North Sea to the other. Whose fish are they? But one of the points is, how do you enforce a fishing quota? What you do is you haul the fish out and see what you've got, and then you either throw them back in, which is extremely wasteful. If you've overfished, say, for monkfish or cod, and you've caught too many, you throw them back in. That does nothing for the fish stocks. It does tick off boxes for regulation. Or, what is equally likely, is if you're a typical fisherman who doesn't really believe in this regulation stuff, you'll try to smuggle them out and use them anyway. And then you won't really want to declare your movements when you come to apply for a fishing license on the grounds that you have traditionally been in certain areas. You'll say, what, me in that area? No, I never lifted 1,000 tons of illegal cod from that area, ever. It's a very fraught and difficult position, messed up by politics and the economics of fisheries, which are not economic at all. I mean, well, I'm a fond fish eater myself, it's good for your brain, but the economics of where they're lifted from, how they're transported, the fuel that's used, the environmental devastation that takes place with the trawling, it is not something you could put your hand on your heart and say, fish is good for you.
Right. Well, I'm sorry, Tony Gosling, but I need to... I'm a bit confused here. I'm trying to figure out, maybe you could clarify this for us, what the agreement is, what are we looking at when it comes to the fish quantity that Ian Williams talked about there, and whether it's a fair agreement or not, so we can get an idea here and why it is. I mean, you said that the UK is looking for errors that are in the applications, I guess. But overall, what are we looking at in terms of what's right and what's fair? And ultimately, if you can tell us, Tony Gosling, well, there was a deal that was made in the form of Brexit, which included this. So who's in the right and who's in the wrong?
Well, for decades, really, you know, 50 years or so, British, I mean, I've seen it in my lifetime. You know, I'm 58 years old. Our fishing ports have been absolutely decimated around Britain. So, you know, ports where there might have been 20, 30 fishing vessels, that's a small port, have dwindled down sometimes to only one or two fishing vessels or none at all. And that's really because the management of the resources of the seas has been managed from Brussels, no longer from Britain. And so there is, I think, you know, quite a righteous anger, really, in the way that that industry has been decimated. Britain, obviously, is a traditionally a maritime nation. But I really want to point out that the timing of this is very interesting. You know, this is quite clearly a sort of row relating to Brexit. We've also seen... the lack of tanker drivers dispute going on here in Britain over the last week or so, which is also very much related to Brexit and to a certain extent confected, because we know that the oil companies can afford to pay, double wages to delivery drivers if they really want to. These people are not short of cash, as anyone involved in the oil industry will tell you. And then we've also had this international geopolitical dispute with the French over the submarines as well, which has got a kind of nautical flavour too, hasn't it? The British and the Americans agreeing to supply nuclear submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, to the Australians under the noses of the French. So it seems to me that this may be a symptom of a much wider problem, and that is the general idea of Brexit, which is rather strange, isn't it? Because it's a couple of years since Brexit, and yet it's taken a while for these things to work their way through. I'll also point out, though, that we've got something else going on in Britain. This is, could be to do with the timing of this, and that is it's the party conference season. This week, it's the Labour Party conference, and next week, the Conservative Party conference. And so these are the sorts of issues which will be being played out in those fringe meetings and in the major debates in those conferences. Uh-huh. And the political leaders will be trying to use these disputes in order to assert their you know, their readiness to lead the country through this difficult, these difficult times.
Sure.
So there's a lot going on at the same time here that I think we should be very, I think, pay attention to the timing of this.
Okay, so let's expand more on the timing and also to get your impression on this, Ian Williams. And before I get your reaction to what our guest Tony Gosling there said, France's Maritime Minister, Annick Girardin, let me make sure I'm pronouncing this correctly, Girardin, said French fishing should not be taken hostage by the British for political ends. It sounds like from what Tony Gosling said that maybe that is what may be going on based on the timing. Do you think that's the case?
Well, look, I think it was the worst part of the deal. I think one of the reasons where Boris Johnson showed he was a liar and Nigel Farage, they said that if we had Brexit, then British fisheries would return. They didn't. All the European Union fisheries carried on getting 65% of the quotas of the fish from the waters. I think it's 65%. But there's another aspect where the European fisheries regime might almost be working, and it's coincidence it happened today, but the European courts have ruled that the European Union had no right to sign a fishing treaty with Morocco about Western Saharan fish. So, you know, fish are moving into the center of the of maritime disputes. As you know, Trump declared that he accepted Western Sahara to be part of Morocco, even though the United Nations hasn't, and the courts haven't. And the European courts have ruled that Western Sahara is occupied territory, and that the French, that the Moroccans, with their French backers, by the way, their French backers, are not allowed to take the fisheries and to give it and to sell the fish there, except for the benefit of the Western Saharans. And just to add to the hypocrisy, I remember some years ago when this dispute was at the United Nations about the straddling fish stocks, the French were in dispute with Canada because they have two offshore islands, like Jersey and Guernsey, just offshore from Canada, and they were fishing right up to them, the full quota. They were fishing in effectively Canadian waters and overfishing, according to the Canadians. So we had a huge dispute there as well. So there are no halos here. No, there are no wings and no shiny armor. The British government lied to its own people. It lied to Europe. The French are quite right there. It's probably being very bureaucratically punctilious about the licenses, but then it's very likely that the French fishermen were lying in their applications by claiming that they're in places that they weren't and denying that they're in places where they were. I mean, there's a lot of anarchy going around here, and you know the regime is pretty much unenforceable, and of course the fish don't get a vote in this. They don't get passports or votes.
Well, again, I'm going to refer to a statement here made, Tony Gosselin, by the French Maritime Minister, where she has said, I count on other European countries to ask for the same thing as France, because what France is going through, they will go through the same thing, the same bad will from Britain, which will not be expressed only on this issue. Do you think that the UK will take up other issues that will be out of the agreement of Brexit, perhaps?
Well, look, I don't think that's the case at all. I think what's happening is Brussels and Paris are picking a fight here with the Brits. I mean, you know, they can apply for these licenses again. You'll probably find that most of those that were turned down will be accepted if they're written down honestly and that these people are actually entitled to fish now. But, you know, this is something which I think it only benefits Brussels by doing this, because what they tend to do is they want to send a message, don't they, to all those other countries that are getting sick and tired of the European Union. And I'm talking here, actually, there's many in France, including the Yellow Vests, who were so cleverly gotten out of the way by all these COVID measures in France, the very strict curfews and things like that. They wanted out of the European Union. They see it as a rich man's club. The same is true in Greece, in many other countries in the EU. In fact, there's many in Germany that want out of the whole Brussels arrangement as well. So these various countries are looking at Britain, how are they getting on? And it actually looks like Britain's been doing reasonably well, doesn't it? Not too many problems over here so far. And so I think we're going into a sort of silly season here where the European Union and the French particularly at the moment are doing everything they can to stir things up and also to try and make it look as if the UK and actually have quite a lot of allies within Britain, these big mega corporations, who transnational corporations who are also pro-EU, that are some of which are based in London, and they are doing whatever they can to stir things up. And this is just simply another example. And it's getting really nasty. I see today in Jersey, they believe in this little Channel Island just off the coast of France, which is owned by the Brits, that they're actually considering now that they may have a blockade of their port because so many of these licenses of the ships based in, the French ships based in Jersey, have been turned down. So they just have to accept this, I think. And it's part of the Brexit deal. If they want to fish, they need a license. And I'm afraid that's just part of the deal. They have to suck it up, I'm afraid.
In Williams, is that going to happen? Do you think the French fishermen especially will do that?
As I said, the French peasantry and the fishermen have a sort of a collective attitude, which is almost proletarian. They believe in collective action. They will dump tomatoes and potatoes on the road to ports. They'll dump rotten fish in places. They will collectively blockade ports. Now, they're allowed to do that because they're a politically important constituency. In Britain, they're not. You know, if they blockaded the port of Dover, then I'm sure a Navy frigate would just go right through the middle of them after due warning. And, you know, they've had it. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But the whole, I did not agree with Britain going into the European Union. But when it did, and recently, I didn't agree with it coming out. I think that Brexit has been a complete disaster all along. And it provides over and over expedient reasons for the government to lie and cheat. Boris Johnson's government lied about Northern Ireland and it broke the agreement. And the sad thing is that for all of its many faults, perfidious Albion, the UK, for many years was actually outstanding for its application of European law, even when it was inconvenient to itself. Unlike some other countries, particularly in the Mediterranean, where the attitude is you took whatever money came from the UN and you refused to accept their responsibilities. If you look at Hungary now, for example, where they want all the UN's, the European Union subsidies, but refuse to accept any of the regulations and the stipulations about free courts that go with it. Britain has been better than that, but in the last few years, it hasn't been. It's sunk into, they're wallowing in the mud with everybody else. Mm-hmm. So there's no telling. There'll be lots of mud to be thrown from both sides.
Okay.
And neither of them are going to be angelic with halos or wings about it. They're all going to be covered in mud. And sure, they deserve it. They've all been involved in sordid politics.
Okay, well, Tony Gosselin, you got this. You got the thing with AUKUS in terms of what happened. Lots of tensions there that have been created. But my question to you is how badly is this relationship at this point negatively affected? And is this just a temporary thing, or how do you see it? How do you project this to go?
Well, okay, so I think our relationship with the French has always been pretty up and down. I mean, though we're very close by, with a very, you know, different language, a different culture. In many ways, the French have got a fantastic culture, haven't they? The food and all that. And I think, we love visiting France. But in terms of the European Union, which the French really represent, they are the EU's in the front line for the EU against Britain. And they're seen, Macron particularly, is seen as the sort of person that has got to teach the Brits a lesson. And I think there's a lot of that almost infantile stuff going on here. The deals have all been signed, and to a certain extent, The British have got some very difficult, we've been used to being dependent on European trade for many, many years, and that's got quite easy for some people. Very, very easy, in fact, to get all sorts of goods across the channel, but without very much paperwork. And now, actually, what's happened is over the last couple of years, all the British industries have done, I think, very well in sourcing stuff much more locally, in going through the paperwork and importing stuff when they need to, but actually being more self-sufficient. And I think that's actually quite important in the modern world, particularly with all the geopolitical tensions that the British are independent here. We've done a fairly good job in making sure that we're establishing control over some resources that we've ceded.
I got to jump in, Tony Gosselin. Sorry, give Ian Williams 30 seconds before we end this. Ian Williams, I saw you shaking your head. Go ahead.
I think the British government have made a disastrous job. They weren't prepared. They didn't seem to realize that Dover was the ports of Dover and Calais were the main route for most goods. They haven't managed to substitute stuff. They have managed to destroy British industry single-handed since the days of Margaret Thatcher. And I come from an industrial area. I watched it happen. I can show you the factories where they used to be. They destroyed British industry. Part of that process was joining the European Union. Since then, they've managed to destroy it all over again because what industry there was left was dependent on an intricate network across Europe, which they're now disrupting for infantile political flag-waving reasons.
Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Thank you very much for that. Let me thank Amina Taylor, our correspondent, spoke to us at the top of the hour, senior analyst of Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, speaking there from New York. And thank you, Tony Gosselin, historian and investigative journalist from Bristol. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tourism. In the the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the 11th program in our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to take you to the city of Yazd in Iran and introduce you to Shahid Sadouqi Hospital in this central Iranian city. Please stay tuned. We have once again come to the city of Yazd to get more acquainted with the tourist areas of this city and also get familiar with one of the city's well-known hospitals, which also operates in the field of health tourism. The city of Yazd is located between the Shirkuh and Kharagnak mountains in a wide plain called the Yazd-Ardakan Plain. Some geographers attribute the date of construction of Yazd to Yazdgerd I, the Sassanid king. But in the Atabakan ruling period, which was one of the feudal dynasties in this region, the city of Yazd developed significantly. Preserving its historical identity, the city of Yazd has become one of the most beautiful cities in Iran today. Historic buildings and monuments abound in the city, and traditional markets and bazaars situated in the old part of the city are all among recreational and tourist attractions of the city of Yazd. The historic city of Yazd includes various old neighborhoods, but among all of them, Fahadan neighborhood is one of the oldest. In this historic city, you can still find many houses belonging to Ilkhanate, that is Ilkhani period, and to the Qajar period. These traditional old-style houses almost invariably feature a central courtyard, a hall, 3-door and 5-door rooms, high walls, beautiful decoration inside the house, picturesque surroundings, and it is interesting that these old houses are still residential and people live in them. Preserving the traditional and historic structure of the city of Yazd has attracted many domestic and foreign tourists to this city. Therefore, a large number of traditional houses in Yazd have been transformed and refurbished into residences suitable for tourists. In fact, tourists can become acquainted with the lifestyle of the people of this city by staying in these refurbished houses. These traditional residences are mostly located in the old part of Yazd. The city of Yazd, steeped in history, is able to attract many foreign tourists with its fascinating places to visit. But the city has also taken significant steps in the field of health tourism for several years and is trying to be successful in attracting health tourists as well. Health tourism is currently one of the most popular kinds of tourism, which in addition to providing health services, will also boost other areas of tourism, such as hotels, transportation, and other sectors of the economy. In the following, we will further discuss the emerging and successful health tourism industry in Yazd. Stay with us. As mentioned earlier, the city of Yazd has taken some valuable steps in the field of health tourism in recent years and is trying to use its urban and historical attractions as well as improving its medical infrastructure to attract even more health tourists. Currently, there are 14 public hospitals in Yazd with 1,582 beds and 7 private hospitals with 983 beds that are offering a range of medical services to patients. Yazd is a leading city in several medical fields such as infertility treatment, cardiovascular disease, dentistry, gynecology, treatment of cancer and diabetes. Several hospitals in Yazd have successfully obtained International Patients Department Permit, that is IPD, in the field of medical tourism for the treatment of foreign patients. One of these hospitals is Shahid Saduqi Hospital, which also accepts foreign patients after receiving its license. Located in southeast part of Yazd in the Safoye district, Shahid Saduqi Hospital was inaugurated in 2001. The hospital is housed in a modern building with a combination of international standards and Iranian architectural art. This hospital is built on a plot of land measuring 50 hectares, and 45,000 square meters of medical space has been built on 5 floors. This modern and well-equipped hospital is known as the largest governmental educational medical and research center in central and southeastern Iran. The hospital has 1,600 personnel, of which 200 doctors and 600 nurses offer medical services to patients. Shahid Saduqi Hospital has succeeded to receive a national first degree accreditation certificate and also has an international patients department, IPD, which has made this hospital one of the best medical centers in Yazd. Shahid Saduqi Hospital consists of different wards, including inpatient ward, paraclinic ward, and emergency ward. Each of them provides different services to patients. The women's ward of the hospital has 30 beds, and all its rooms are fully equipped with medical equipment, as well as a TV, refrigerator, and a sofa to cater for the patient and anyone accompanying him or her, as well as a nurse call system. The operating rooms of the hospital also include two sections of general surgery and gynecological surgery. In the general ward, there are 13 operating beds and 34 recovery beds. And in the gynecology ward, there are 3 operating beds and 5 recovery beds. Having this number of surgical beds makes it possible to perform several operations at the same time. The international patient ward of the hospital is located on the ground floor, and the reception, treatment, and hospitalization services for foreign patients are provided in this ward. The doctors of the IPD department of the hospital are among the best specialists and super specialists who are in charge of all the medical affairs of the foreign patients. Foreign patients are referred to the relevant doctors in the shortest possible time after being admitted to this ward and providing required documents, and the treatment process begins afterwards. In the case of the need for hospitalization or surgery, the follow-ups will be carried out by the international ward personnel. Due to the potentials and capacities in the city of Yazd, especially the successful records in the field of in vitro fertilization or IVF, or infertility treatment founded by Professor Aflatunian in Yazd many years ago, many patients come to this city for infertility treatment. Shahid Saduqi Hospital in Yazd has expressed readiness for various kinds of treatments due to these potentials and enjoying from super specialty departments and doctors. The hospital is also trying to promote the hospital through media and tourism companies, and to upgrade its position in order to attract more medical tourists. Dear listeners, that was the 11th episode of the series Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Good morning.
heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.